special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I am so excited to welcome Dr. Timothy Kremchek today because we are already looking forward to the red seasons, and he's going to tell us all about his work and his business, and we're just going to look forward to spring on this very cold winter day. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you have been involved with the Reds for more than 25 years.
It'll be 29 years this year.
As the team doctor, Dr. Hollywood, Doc, we'll get into that.
I heard that in passing today. I don't know the backstory.
Now, our Scott Springer did a story on you not too long ago. But since then, you have sort of stepped down from the direct role of team doctor and more of a consultant. Is that right? Or how's that working for you? Because there were people, I among them, who said, I don't think he can fully walk away from that job. He's just too involved.
Well, you're a very astute man. I really couldn't. It's, you know, for years, taking care of the Reds since 1996, I went to every game. Went on road trips, spring training, down there an hour and a half, 2 hours before the game, hour after the game. So I stepped away from that. But I still go down most games, still see the players, have one of my junior partners, Andrew Rosano, does a lot of the day-to-day stuff. But I'm down there seeing the players, still fly in to see me, still talk with the front office, still very involved with the team, still very – I love baseball, love the Reds. You know, from the day I stepped foot in Cincinnati in 1968, I've been a huge Reds fan, and it's just part of me. And I think it'll be part of me until I'm no longer here. So, yeah, as a consultant, that's great. Sounds whatever – everybody wants to be a consultant. Whatever, I always hear people say, I want to be a consultant, but I'm still knee deep in it, and I love every second of it. And I'm looking forward to spring too, by the way.
Well, I think a lot of people are. So I think in terms of the health of the team, many Reds fans are excited that Matt McClain will be back.
Yeah.
That was a long time away. What can you tell us about,
you know, Matt,
how things look?
Matt, first of all, very optimistic. I mean, if you really look at where this team is, what's been built, you know, what the Castellini family, Nick Kroll, Brad Metter have put together, bringing Tito Francona in as a manager, I think the nucleus of this team is unbelievably rosy. The look of it, what we've got. I mean, you don't trade away a guy like Jonathan India, who's a staple of the team, was really an unbelievable guy in the locker room, could hit, was really the heart and soul of the team, unless you've got a lot of guys to fall back on. And you can go position by position, whether it's catcher with Stevenson and Canasio Strand or Steer at first base, McClain at second, Ellie De La Cruz at short. I think Marte got a bad rap from the beginning of spring training last year when he, you know, kind of made a mistake as far as you know, some of the things that they did in the Dominican. And I think that carried over with him and didn't contribute to his season. He's an unbelievable ball player. And then you've got Friedel and Fraley and really a core pitching staff. And we just picked up a pitcher from the Kansas City Royals that's really going to be a staple with our young pitchers. A lot to look forward to, really. And a lot of depth, quite honestly, in the minor leagues. And so, yeah, Matt McClain, again, showed as a rookie what he could do. He's a great ball player. I think his treatment and his injury, everybody wanted to make sure that he was going to be 100%, didn't want to rush him back. Although, you know, when we got to August, there were people itching to get him back. It was the right thing to do to hold him back and get him whole and get him ready for the 25 season. So very optimistic.
So let me ask you, and Burl probably knows the answer to this, and a lot of our listeners I know are very, very, you know, sports oriented from talking to them. But do you kind of help? You don't just treat them like before and after the games. Do you help assess?
Oh, yeah.
That's part, a big part of the job of like, oh, I don't know what they're going to be like once they get here.
You know, it's funny. I have partners of mine that don't do sports medicine that said, oh, I could be the team doctor. Yeah, come up, go to the training room for a minute, go up, have a hot dog and watch the game. It's not like that at all. Yeah, sure. I mean, this, you, if you don't immerse yourself into the program, the players have to know you. You have to know them, their families, where they've been, where they're going, what their goals are, where they fit into the organization. And then you have to be able to communicate. They have to be able to trust you. They have to be able to trust you with things that they don't want others to know, with their health, part of what's going on with their family. You have to, so to do that, you have to be there all the time. You have to be available to all the time. So you're actually part of the team, but not. You're not wearing a uniform, but you're certainly a huge part of the team. Some of my best friends over the last 30 years have been guys like Barry Larkin, guys like Ken Griffey Jr., Aaron Boone, people that I've gotten to know their families, treated them, their families forever. So yes, this is all about immersion. So when you say consultant, you know, consultant sees somebody in the office, makes a diagnosis and treats them. Somebody who's really, really immersed into the team really gets to know the personalities. I mean, there's a lot of personalities, how they are affecting other people in a clubhouse, how their moods affect how they play, what's going on with their families and slumps and things of that sort. So yeah, it is a more than a full-time job. It can be very rewarding, can be very stressful when you're sitting watching every game, hanging on to every pitch in a ninth inning with two outs, bases loaded, hoping that you win and break this losing streak. I'm going to call it a career. It's not just a job.
So let's talk about how you became the team physician. You started, I guess, heavy into sports medicine. You were a founding partner for Beacon Orthopedic, but your foot in the door was actually with the Cyclones. Is that right?
Hey, well, I'm a baseball guy. I mean, I grew up through second grade in Boston. My father was in the Air Force and huge Red Sox fan. In 1968, we moved here. I followed the Red Sox 67 World Series. I could name you the team for the Red Sox and the Cardinals of seven games. Bob Gibson pitching against Jim Lomborg at game seven and cried and kicked and screamed all the way moving back to when my father came into practice in Cincinnati. And yeah, the first thing he did at September 4th, 1968, was take me to Crosley Field. I'll never forget it. Sat behind home plate and watched Jim Maloney pitch against a guy named Nelson Briles, pitching for the St. Louis Cardinals. Pete Rose had three hits that game. Johnny Bench was the catcher. I can name the whole starting lineup for the team. And got a bobblehead, and I was a Reds fan after that. There was no looking back since 1968. And so when I went off into training, I played baseball in school, mm-hmm. and I always wanted to be a baseball player. And other than the fact that I couldn't throw and couldn't run and was a mediocre fielder, I could hit okay, but my father called me on the phone and said, you're not going to make it in baseball. You got to think of something else. So I went into medicine.
So you became a doctor.
Nice to fall back on.
And yeah. I used to. Now, yeah.
Did you play in college?
I did. I went to Wittenberg University and played first base.
Okay.
And you have to understand, through all of these times, I mean, I could name you the starting rotations of the 1970 Reds team, 72, 73 that lost to the Mets, 74 that we came in fourth place, 75, 76, obviously. And as all this was transpiring, I would come to these games and sit behind in the green seats at the old Riverfront Stadium. And I would tell my friend, who actually became the CEO of Beacon, worked with my wife, Hillary, at Procter & Gamble. I said, you know, one day I'm going to be the Reds doctor. And I was in medical school. He looked at me. He goes, really? I don't think so. And that's what I wanted to be. And so I went off to Boston. And
this is where you did your residency?
I did my residency mm-hmm. in orthopedics. And I'm standing there as a fourth-year medical student rotating in Boston. I'm standing in the right field bleachers at Fenway Park, and this gray-haired lady came up with sunglasses. And I was looking around like probably like an idiot. I had a polo shirt, blue jeans on, and she's saying, are you trying to get a ticket? And I said, yeah, I don't know where to buy a ticket here. I found out it was Mrs. Yawkey. And Mrs. Yawkey was the wife of Bud Yawkey, who was the owner of the Red Sox. Takes me up to the box. We watched the game. She finds out all about, we talk about everything. I mean, he invited me to the game the next night. Now, her husband had passed. Well, she helped me get my residency in Boston. So I go and I'm a resident in Boston. I'm at the Mass General, Brigham and Women's, you know, all these white coat, staunch, stuffy Bostonian. And I used to ride my bicycle to Fenway Park. And all the players would come in. I was the biggest kid there. There were a bunch of 12-year-olds and me. And I'm watching the Red Sox come in. I was just in heaven. Well, there's a guy named Lou Gorman, who was the general manager. And I said, Lou, what happened to Roger Clemens? Because Roger Clemens pitching. He said, he's having surgery. I said, surgery? He said, yes, some guy in Birmingham, Alabama, Jim Andrews. I said, Jim, I never heard of him. Looked him up. I said, I'm going to go spend time with Jim Andrews to be a baseball doctor. And lo and behold, I did. I spent a year with Jim Andrews. And I came back here and I started taking care of the Cyclones, the 1992 hockey team. Well, I would go to every game. This was at the Gardens at 10,000, 11,000 per game. I loved it. Loved it. Well, Jim Bowden, who was the general manager of the Reds at that point, found out we had a guy on his hockey team named Paul Lawless. Paul Lawless had hurt his foot. He had the same injury that Jeff Brantley had. And we took care of Paul Lawless. He's back out skating. He called me into the office, said, how did you guys fix this? And I told him how my ultimate goal was to take care of the Reds. I love baseball. We spent 3 hours and he hired me. He said, you want the job? He goes, I'll give you a year. I said, I'll come to every game. He goes, no, you won't. I said, yeah, I will. He goes, no, you won't. I said, yes, I will. And I went to spring training, went to every game, and he made me the medical director in 1997 after that. And then the rest was history because that's all I needed. That's all I wanted. You know, the first guy that came up to me in spring training, we were in Plant City. Never been to Plant City. It was Strawberry Festival down there. And I walked into my first day, and the first guy that came up to me, came all the way across, was Barry Larkin, put his hand out, and he goes, I'm glad you're here. And after that, everybody else kind of went, okay, he's cool.
So did you end up operating on Brantley's foot? Was that?
My associate did.
Okay.
Yes, and took care of Brantley. And, you know, subsequent, Brantley's been a patient, a friend, and all that. But, yeah, took care of Brantley. And it's not just taking care of him to surgery. It was more about, like I said, understanding what he was all about, getting him on a mend, put him on the right rehab, understood what it was going to take and what he meant to the team coming, you know, into the season in 1997. This was really important. Things that, you know, you don't think about as a doctor. You don't, a doctor? Yeah, but you're part of the team. You're part of the program. You're a little bit different position than a trainer, but you're still, and I think Jim understood this, and I give Jim Bowden a lot of credit. Jim Bowden took a lot of grief when he was here, but he gave me a chance. Subsequently, when he went to Washington, he made me a consultant for the Washington Nationals too. So, you know, from that day on, I was down there all the time, off-season, spring training, meetings, Sarasota when we moved to Goodyear, and thank goodness. I remember when Bob Castellini took over, you know, he had a meeting with me. I'm thinking he's going to fire me. I don't know why I thought that. And we've become great friends ever since. And again, it's a journey that started back then that you asked me if I'm a consultant. I don't think I could ever let it go.
So what is it like to operate and do something like so important? Like we just last year went through like Joe Burrow's wrist injury. Ended up writing about like what that was all about. What is it like going into that operating room with a Reds player knowing that their entire career is pinned on it? Is it more pressure or is it just it's a surgery because it's a person? What?
No, you know, somebody told me, I'll tell you what happened. When I first started taking care of the players, once you become one of the guys and they trust you, then they all come to you. And so there is pressure there. You have to understand who they are, what they are. And as Marty Brenneman told me, and he said it, and we get into the Doc Hollywood stuff. He's the one that started that.
Oh, see, I love a good segue.
But Marty said, let me tell you something, Doc Hollywood. The lights can be bright, but they can also be very hot. And I've had both. And I think you think about it, but you try to get that out of your mind. I one of the greatest stories that to the day I die will be my Ken Griffey story. And Ken Griffey came to the Reds. I was sitting in the operating room. I heard over the radio that the Reds were trading for the Seattle Mariners, Ken Griffey. Well, I obviously knew his father. So Griffey came with all the hoopla and, you know, he was this bigger than life. And he comes in the locker room and Deion Sanders was on the team at this point and you know, Josh Hamilton, all these guys. I got to know Junior very well and we became extraordinarily good friends. Well, he's in San Francisco. I'm watching a game. He hurts himself.
That was the hamstring injury?
Hurts his hamstring.
And that wasn't just a pulled hamstring. Well, that was like.
Right.
Yeah.
And he hurts himself and I'm thinking, okay. And a week goes by. I'm driving in my car and I get this call. You know, it's on overhead. He goes, this is how he would call. He goes, yow. And I said, what's up? He goes, I need an MRI. I said, Junior. We don't MRI hamstrings. They just, you know, we let them. He goes, I need your junior. We'll get an MRI. So I get an MRI, and he had pulled the bone, the tendons completely off the bone. Something you rarely see. It's a water skiing injury, and so he comes to the office. I said, hey, I've not seen this before, but there's a guy down in North Carolina takes care of the women's soccer team that's done a number of these. So I sent him, and the trainer at the time was Greg Lynn, flew him down to North Carolina. They met with this doctor, and this doctor said, yes, we need to fix this. They called me on the phone. I said, okay. So I'm in my office the next day, get a knock on the door, and it's Junior. I said, what are you doing here? He goes, I need surgery. I said, yeah, I know. He goes, when are we going to do it? I said, well, I've not done this before. He goes, well, you're a doctor. I trust you. I said, give me a couple days. And we did it.
What'd you do? Go on YouTube?
I had never done one before, ever. But the point of it is this, is that he trusted me. He knew I would do anything I could to help him. And what happened was we fixed it. And the hardest part is we put him in a little scooter. Well, I had a little scooter that was maroon. And he looked at me and he goes, and I went over to visit him at Adam's Landing where we were staying. And he's laying on a couch and he goes, we got a problem. I said, what's the problem? He goes, either I'm going to lay on this couch for 6 months or we're going to get that scooter painted because I won't go out in public with a maroon scooter. So we had to take it home and trick it out. We painted it black and my kids and I, we put it all together. He came back the next year and won comeback player of the year. So he goes to this guy in Sports Illustrated, and Sports Illustrated, and I have these in my office sequentially, of him going over the wall when he was with the Mariners, catching a ball, throwing it, throwing a guy out at home plate. And it's like seven pictures, and they're huge. And he had signed it, and the last one said, the only other guy that could do this wore a cape. Well, I got him framed. It cost me $7,000 to get him framed. I said, thanks for the gift. Thanks for the gift, buddy. Thanks for the gift.
Those must have been giant pictures.
But you know what? You take care of the guys like that. You ask me that. You kind of have to put it behind you and say, okay, I was straight up with them. But that's just what it means to be part of the program, part of the team, part of, you know, my little contribution to helping the team. And, you know, I still get shivers thinking about it because of the trust they put in you and the time that you put in down there. And, you know, people aren't stupid. They realize when you want to be there, when you're doing it for a job or when you're doing it because you love it.
We didn't hear about Doc Hollywood.
Yeah, so now that we've mentioned it a couple of times, why did Marty bestow that nickname upon you?
Well, first of all, Marty.
he's bestowed many.
Oh, yeah, trust me. I mean, let me just qualify this. So Marty injured, and he'll tell you that, he injured his elbow. And I had to fix it. He's on the operating room table, about ready to go to sleep, and he sits up.
Was he like leaning on the stats book? Was it like a stats injury?
I think that's a golfing injury. Okay. And if you ever watched him play golf, you'd know why he injured himself. Let me just put it that way. He's no Scottie Scheffler. So he sits up, and before he gets the anesthesia, he sits up. Everybody in the OR, and he goes, you better not, and I'll use the F word, this up. Because if you do, it'll be on the radio. And you think operating on all these other guys was tough? He goes, you're not saying anything. That's great. Thanks, buddy. So anyway, so I'm standing in 1997. Back then, Jim Bowden would take a lot of heat because he would always describe the injuries. Well, he didn't know about the injuries. And the press would always push him. And it was tough. So finally, he got comfortable with me. And he said, all right, anybody, this was before HIPAA and all that stuff. So he'd say, anytime a player gets hurt, you're going to have this, and you're going to meet with Rob Butcher, all the Inquirer, all these guys, and we're going to talk. And I said, okay. So I'm there, and there's somebody must have gotten hurt. Something must have happened. It might have been Barry Larkin. Who knows? And I'm standing there, there's a group of people, and here comes Marty off the elevator, and he goes, you got to be kidding me. You're Doc Hollywood. You are Doc Hollywood. I wouldn't listen to a damn word he says. I'm sitting there like shaking, thinking I'm just starting
Marty's
to do
voice.
This. Yeah, and from that day, I'm Doc Hollywood. No matter where I am.
So nothing to do with the, you know, the cowboy Doc Hollywood. Uh-huh. This is you went Hollywood. You went
Well, that's
big time.
What he meant by you, it, though. Yeah, I'm Doc became, Hollywood.
Well, and I think I don't know too many other team physicians that had the media profile you did around that time.
I got to tell you, first of all,
like people, I'm sure you get recognized. People say, hey, Doc Hollywood or Dr. K or whatever. Like
I have people, you know, the ball players sign it to me, Hollywood, you know, they'll see it in my office. But, you know, that was not a goal. I knew the injury. I knew what to say. I knew how long it was going to take. I'd always ask a player, say, you know, I'm going to they're going to ask. And they said, Doc, you tell them, you know better than I do. And it's better. And it became comfortable. And Marty just liked the jab because he was the first guy that said, I want you on the radio in the third inning to go over. Okay. So, all of that, though, you know, you talk about a guy like Marty Brenneman. So I used to tease him. I'd say, really? I said, how hard is it to get on the air and call a baseball game? Anybody could do that. Well, that used to really tick him off.
It's like coming back to me now. Man, I remember this because I would always listen. He puts you on the mic.
I was on a mic.
Yeah, he made you do play-by-play.
Well, now, wait a second. I want to be very clear here. So he would do this, and he would set me up. And Nuxie would be to the left, and he was to the right. And I'll never forget this. I did a spring training, did this, and we're playing, I think it was like 2003. We're playing the Houston Astros. And I got the sixth inning, I think. He goes, you're sixth inning. So I'm sitting in a booth. There's not, and then Marty doesn't just let you call the game. He's jabbing you the whole time, calling you names, flipping you off, whatever it's going to take over there. And I'm like, Nuxie's over here. So finally I said, you try to fill the time. And I'm trying to prove to him that I can do this. So I said, all right, I hope we get to the bullpen. I really do. I mean, the Astros bullpen has really struggled. We can hit them. We can get into the seventh inning. We can win this game. I said, the Astros bullpen is really struggling. Next day, Astros player gets hurt. I go down to Riverfront Stadium into the Astros training room. There's Nuxall doing a pregame show. And I'm sitting in there, and all of a sudden, Billy Wagner, the left-hander, really kind of a tough guy, little guy, their closer, comes and goes, who was on the radio? I heard there's some doctor on the radio. If I get a hold of him, I'm going to kick his ass. I'm going to go crazy. And I'm sitting there with Nuxie. Nuxie goes, I'm going to tell him. I said, don't you say a word. Nuxie goes, I'm going to tell him. I said, I got Bagwell, Biggio. I got that whole team in there. The last thing I know would be is stuck in a training room with the Astros. And Marty's, he thinks that's the funniest thing that ever happened in his life. Again, it's just being part of the team. It's like the time when I used to work out during the games and Pete Harnisch was on the team and they knew that when somebody went down, so I'm working out. Well, all of a sudden.
You mean like in the gym?
Yeah,
like
in the weight room. I'm okay, in the weight room. Right. I'm doing an elliptical, whatever it was.
So like the game starts, players are on the field.
Yeah.
You hit the weight room.
Yeah.
Okay. Makes sense to me.
I'm doing my thing. And all of a sudden, somebody goes, hey, Barry Larkin's down. I go, oh no. I run in because you have to go out in the field. I run in. I put my pants on. They had cut the bottom of my pants went to the top. They cut my tie in half. The belt broke. And they're all, ah. They think it's the funniest thing. I'm sitting there thinking, what am I going to do? How am I going to run out there naked on the field? I mean, it was hysterical. I mean, these guys, trust
fun.
Me, when you talk about practical
fun.
Jokers, there are a bunch of them. But again, doing it made you feel, it just made me feel part of it. It's like when Denny Nagel, he remember Denny Nagel?
Oh, yeah.
Denny Nagel said, Doc, you want to meet, this is embarrassing almost. You want to meet Sugar Ray? I said, sure. So he goes, come on down. So he's down there and he goes, he's standing with some white guy next to him. And I said, where is he? He goes, he's right here. I said, where's Sugar Ray? He goes, right here. I thought he meant the boxer. He goes, I never heard of the other Sugar Ray. My kids are calling me on the phone. Give me a Sugar Ray baseball sign. I'm thinking, that's Sugar Ray? Talk about, so there's a little bit of an age discrepancy there.
Well, you've been with the team long enough. You've seen, you know, you were talking about Barry Larkin. You know, those are guys probably around your age. And now you're dealing with people probably the age of your children. Is that hard to, like, what have you had to do to change the way you approach working with them?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. Really, it is. I think
I get paid for them. Thank you.
But it's no different than what you do in the office. I mean, you see the high school kids, the college kids. We take care of Miami University now. You have to put yourself in a position of, you know, when you're dealing with Barry Larkin, we're the same age. So we talk about the same things. We talk about the same things growing up, the same going to school, how you went to Muller High School, these kind of things. Now the young kids, you have to put yourself in a position of, you know, a somewhat of authority, but still, but down to the level of understanding why you know, why should I come to you? Why should I let you fix me? Do you understand what I need, what I want to do, what I'm all about? And I think that's the art of medicine. It's the art of sports medicine, making your patients feel comfortable with who you are, why you are. I mean, everybody can walk around and say, I'm the greatest surgeon in the world, and there's a lot of great ones. But the idea is, it's not that. It's the idea of wanting to be there, understanding how you're going to help them and making them feel comfortable. And now I have to do that with the Reds, like I would say kids from Moeller High School or Lakota West or Miami or Wittenberg or whoever. So,
well, let's talk about, you do work with some high schools in the area. You mentioned Moeller. What are you seeing? What types of injuries? What type, you know, have things changed because of the specialization? You know, you don't have like four sport athletes anymore because you start, you kind of commit at like age 12 at club level sports. And what did you tell parents from your perspective? What aren't they seeing, or what do they need to know?
You know, it's, first of all, there's physical injury, there's mental fatigue, there's burnout. And I see a lot of burnout. A lot of burnout. You know, that when I was a kid, you played baseball in the summertime, you played 16 games. Hopefully you got 16 in. It rained half the time. Now these kids are playing, they're playing ball for their school team. They're playing 30 games, and they're playing 100 games in the summer. And by the time, I couldn't wait to continue to play baseball. Now they're getting burned out. They're tired of it. And not only that, but then there's the physical fatigue. We know that fatigue causes injury. And so there's a lot of problems now in, I think, youth sports. And it starts, number one, with the top, coaching, and sometimes parents. They push the kids too much. Kids are doing things not for them, but for their parents or for their coaches. We're getting kids to try to throw the ball harder than they've ever thrown before. The best players are always pitching or playing in the field, and then they wonder why they get hurt. So we're seeing a lot of attritional burnout, fatigue injuries. We're also seeing the level of play in these kids now. You know, I covered the state championship for Moeller High School against a team in Columbus, Liberty. And these kids are, you're talking about offensive linemen are 300 pounds. Back when I played, they were 200 to 220. Bobby Crable, when he played for Moeller High School, was probably 195, 200 pounds, went to Notre Dame, went on to the Jets. But that was big back then.
Right.
When Big Brown played offensive tackle back then, you know, he was 240, 250 pounds, but he was huge and ended up going to Penn State. Now these guys are 300 pounds on a line. And these kids are getting hurt. They're playing on turf fields now. And the turf fields, there's a big controversy between, you know, grass and turf. Because on a turf, your cleats get caught into the ground, and your foot gets stuck. The turf doesn't give. So what's going to give? Your ankle, your knee? And that's why you get all these blowout knee injuries. Whereas if you had turf, the turf gives away. It's like dirt. So your shoe gives away in it. Problem is with dirt fields and regular grass, it's expensive to maintain. It's very difficult to play multiple sports on them. And so now all these schools have some type of, you know, field turf so they can play field hockey, soccer, football. And
you can see that though in high schools, which with money would be an issue. But why would it still be any sort of conversation in professional leagues anywhere with the idea
they talking about maybe Paycor Stadium?
It's a huge conversation in professional sports. They have all the money in the world. Why wouldn't they just have, so what if it's expensive to maintain grass?
No matter what you say as far as having all the money in the world, everybody cries poverty. And
oh, I have heard
and,
that.
And,
yeah.
And that's the truth. I mean, and if you ask players, there are players that go to teams in the NFL because they have the turf they practice on and the turf they play on to be able to prolong their careers. We're not just talking about knee and shoulder injuries. We're talking about concussions now, guys hitting the ground. And there's no excuse. Like Phoenix, you'd think Phoenix, there's no way Phoenix, Arizona can have regular turf, but they do. They wheel it in and wheel it out because they know that the players that they're going to get in Phoenix want to play on natural turf. It's safer and it prolongs their careers. You know, there are guys, when I started with the Reds, I found there were guys, and you talk about Deion Sanders. I remember when Terry Pendleton came to the Reds from Atlanta, he had some of the worst knees I've ever seen. Well, they played on his AstroTurf that was so thin and it was cement underneath it. And they're running around that all the time. They had arthritis. And I'm thinking baseball players? It's unbelievable. You know, one of my better friends over the years, and I hope we get to talk about Pete Rose and who he's all about, how I met him. But Pete Rose will tell you, he said, AstroTurf probably takes 3 or 4 years off some of these guys that play over 10 years in a league that played early on.
Right. Yeah. The original AstroTurf that you were describing was basically a carpet on top of some asphalt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then they showed them bouncing a ball.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was great for players who took advantage of it, like Dave Concepcion, who could make those bounce throws.
Exactly.
But.
Well, you're older than I thought.
I look young, don't I? No, not at all.
You look great.
Well, we do want to talk to you about Pete Rose. Yes, but before that, let's kind of close the loop. We were just getting into the talk about high school athletes, burnout, fatigue causing injuries. I see this as kind of almost like an unsolvable situation, because if they want to play college, they can't just be playing during the regular high school season. They're going to be playing at a club level. Parents are going to be driving all over the place, whether it's baseball or football or lacrosse now.
Soccer
the same way. Can you strike that balance between letting a high school athlete play a different sport or take part of the year off just to avoid that fatigue? Or if they have dreams of, college or professional, it's got to become their life. I mean, what's the answer to that question?
Well, the answer is you should. Number one, you should take time off.
So this is your doctor medical advice.
Yeah, and I've been saying this for 20 years. I mean, you have to take time off. You have to take mentally and physically, you have to take the time off. Plus, I've always been an advocate of playing a different sport. When Scott Rolen came to the Reds, he was going to play for the Indiana Hoosier basketball team. He said the greatest thing he ever did, and he's in the Hall of Fame now, was play two sports, because you use different muscles, you become a better athlete, and it allowed him not to have the mental and the physical fatigue of baseball. Now the problem is the pressure and the monies. Even the summertime, these leagues that get sponsored, the coaches that get paid, the parents that have these dreams of kids making seven figures, the NIL deals. You asked me before, is it difficult to the pressure taking care of these professional athletes? And I'll tell you what, it's more pressure taking care of the kid that's a junior in high school that has no way to go to college unless he gets a scholarship. He gets hurt. It's more pressure getting him right, getting his insurance plan, rehab, everything he can, back onto the field to play, to be seen, so he can get a college education. Because if I tell the parents, he doesn't play a sport, who's he hanging around with on Friday night? He's hanging out at the Pony Keg, a different group of people. His whole demographic and his whole life changes, as opposed to if he's on a field, going to the playoffs and going on to college, getting some money to play ball. And now maybe even some NIL money, not only, a scholarship. So the pressure is not the guys that are making, $3, $4, $5, $7, $10 million a year, although that's pressure. It's pressure to get these kids. And guys like me, it's not the professional athlete. It's really not. That's fun. If you love sport, it's great. But it's all about taking care of these kids, making sure they understand what to do, when to do it, how to do it, educating the parents. Curveballs in baseball. I have more kids that think their kid's going to be the next Sandy Koufax in sixth grade. We have kids now that are getting offered scholarships in football and baseball when they're in ninth grade, eighth grade. Give me a break, And so the pressure that mounts from these kids is absolutely enormous, because the families don't have the monies. They go home and say the only way you can go to school, the only way you're going to make it, the only way you're going to make it for the family is for you to make it. You're a great athlete. And these kids, the mental aspect, and we talk about depression, we talk about burnout, we talk about all these kids that have all these social issues. I think a lot of it stems from that. And I see it every day. I see more parents fighting in my office, mom understanding the son or daughter against the father. Yeah, always when the father comes in with the short pants, baseball cap, baseball shirt that the kid wears, ready to go with cleats, and the kid's hurt, can't play. Dad wants to go out, he can tough it out. Those are battles sometimes. And I sometimes feel like Jerry Springer, trying to deal with that kind of stuff.
All right. So, Pete Rose, your first Reds game was at Crosley Field.
Yes.
As you said earlier, I'm sure Pete was in the lineup.
Pete was in the lineup. I didn't know Pete Rose, but I'll tell you what. If you've been to Crosley Field,
I know. My family moved here in '77, and the Reds were already at Riverfront.
So
I missed the whole Crosley Field experience.
That was a different age back then. My parents used to drive me to the Marymount Theater, put me on a bus, that went directly to Crosley Field. I was in fourth grade. 8:05 game. I'd get the ticket, go to the game, and come home on a bus. They'd pick me up at the Marymount Theater and take me home. You don't do that anymore.
No.
The point is, around Crosley Field, if you went around the left field line behind, there was bars, you know, like prison bars, where the players would come down the stairs and they would sign autographs. And sometimes they would come out of the bars and go to the dugout. And I must have gone to 20 games a year as a kid at Crosley, 68, 69, and first half of 70, till they moved to Riverfront June 30th, 1970. Every day, every single day, Pete Rose would come down the stairs and sign autographs. Every day. And I got to the point where I didn't want his autograph. I just wanted to shake his hand. He was the nicest guy. The one I wanted was Johnny Bench. And Johnny Bench would rarely come. One day, Johnny Bench came through at a program. It was those two-page cardboard programs. Dave Bristol was the manager. Pat Corrales signed. Johnny Bench came out and signed. Some kid slugged me in the stomach, stole it. I tell Johnny Bench that story every time. I've operated on him a number of times. I love it. And he goes, "Oh, Doc, I'll sign your program for you." And as I relaxed,
it's not the same.
But Pete, I didn't know Pete then, but I knew of him. And when I became the Reds doctor, Pete became a patient. And Pete would come to, I mean, Pete, you can say what you want about Pete Rose. I love Pete Rose. I love him. I love him. I love him. He would come to my office, and I don't think he had anything to do. Him and Arnie would come over, and they'd sit there for 2 hours in my little room, and they just BS. I just wanted to talk. I said, "Pete, I got to go to work." One day, I'm sitting in the office. It's Saturday morning, and all of a sudden, I'm talking to this patient. A door opens. It's Pete. He sits down. This guy's on a table. He goes, "Hey, what's wrong with you? What you got going on?" "My knee." He goes, "Yeah, I had a problem with my knee." And da-da. I said, I got to work. The guy looks at me and goes, "Do you know who that was?" I said, "Yeah, I know who it was. It was Pete Rose."
He won't be treating you today. I will.
Pete was just one. I mean, he took my son and I to a brunch. Pete, first of all, Pete never paid for anything, but he did this. He invited me. And so my son was 12, 13. And he was, it's one of the greatest stories. He's got to talk stories all day long. I could talk baseball all day long with him. And he said, we were talking about him signing autographs in Las Vegas. And he had story after story. And he said, this one lady came up to him and she said, "Mr. Rose, my husband played for the Detroit Tigers for 20 years. "Oh, really?" He said, "Really, honey? Really? What's his name?" "Bill Smith." He goes, "Bill Smith. Never heard of Bill Smith." She goes, "Yeah, he played for the Tigers for 20 years. She goes, "Honey, I know every baseball player that's played. I played with him, American League, National League. I never heard of Bill Smith." Well, she got all upset and left. Found out he played the organ for the for the Detroit Tigers. But and that's just Pete. I mean, but Pete, you know, he the saddest, I think one of the saddest things in baseball for me was when he was not able to be able to be down with, he just liked being around baseball. He came down one time at down the stadium and the Reds were taking batting practice. And he took a bat. This is 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. And he took a bat and hit the ball inside. They had a little L and was hitting BBs right back to the pitcher. And he said, when we were taking, and so these players would get in and they were hitting, trying to hit bombs, this, that, and everything else. He said, when we were playing in the 70s, the managers and coaches would say, you couldn't get out of the batter's box until you hit 15 in a row right up the middle. So you could do it. 15 to left field, 15 to right, then you got out. Now these guys are trying to hit it over this. And Pete, at age 75, was choom, choom, choom. And Joey Votto, Brandon Phillips, all these guys, their eyes are wide open going, oh, my goodness gracious. That's incredible. But that was Pete. He just loved baseball. He didn't need, he just liked the game. Loved the game. And I loved him because of it. I thought he was awesome. Joe Morgan the same way. Johnny Bench in a different way.
Talk a little bit about what you think Pete's legacy will be now.
You know, I still...
if you can, as a friend. I mean, do you think, you know, does he get into the Hall? Does the, you know... The fact that Major League Baseball now makes money off of sports gambling, do you think in time, how will Pete be remembered? Or how do you want him to be remembered?
I want Pete Rose to be remembered as to what he meant to baseball and what baseball meant to him. You know, again, I think I'm going to cry when I say this, but I had a birthday and my wife got me a birthday present. The greatest player growing up I ever loved was Willie Mays. And through Dusty Baker, who is a friend of Willie's, my wife would call Dusty Baker and said, my husband's birthday, his favorite player, we'll take care of that. So anyway, it's in July. And so July's coming around, my wife's driving. She hears on the radio, she goes, and Billy Mays died. She almost drove off the road. Well, it was Billy Mays, the guy that did the glue commercials, you know, Billy Mays.
And
so anyway, we went and
Flex Seal.
She almost didn't make it. So on the phone talking to Willie Mays, you know, and she doesn't, I mean, it's Willie Mays. She just knew what he meant to me. We spent 2 days with Willie Mays, and all Willie Mays wanted to talk about was Pete Rose. He said when he was coming up and the Giants were coming to Cincinnati, the only guy that they were segregated and the black players had to stay in a hotel. He said every time the players would come to the game, he said Pete Rose would come over to their neighborhood and play stickball with them, play cards. Pete Rose didn't care. There was no color barrier with Pete Rose. It was all about playing a game, being part of the game, and what it was. And Pete Rose, I want his legacy to say, number one, a man who loved baseball, a man who was probably one of the greatest baseball players that ever played, who made his mistakes. We're all human. But unfortunately, and I don't think Pete Rose, by the way, I don't think he wanted to be in the Hall of Fame to have a plaque. I think if you would have said to Pete Rose, you can either have the Hall of Fame or be involved with baseball, he'd say, I don't want the Hall of Fame. I just want to be around the guys. I want to be around baseball. I want to see the players. I want to watch the team. I love the Cincinnati Reds. So I want his legacy to be one of the greatest players to ever play the game. And nobody loved the game more than Pete Rose. Nobody. I have not met anybody in 30 years that can honestly say they love the game of baseball more than Pete Rose. And I know a lot of players that love the game of baseball.
Well, I can't think of a better ending than that. Dr. Kremchek, Doc Hollywood, thank you for sharing those stories today. We should actually ask you for your official prediction on this season. What are we looking at?
Reds?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to make a very bold prediction.
Oh,
here.
We love that here.
I think the Reds this year are going to run away with the Central Division. I do. I'm going to tell you they do. And I'm going to tell you they're going to have enough starting pitching to get deep into the playoffs. And I'm going to stop at that. But I think, again, a lot of things have to play. I think they've got a Hall of Fame manager. They've got young nucleus of players that have some experience now. They've got a city of Cincinnati that's second to none as far as following baseball. There's no better baseball town than Cincinnati, Ohio. None. I don't care what you say, where you go. You can go to, you know, Chicago, Wrigley Field is the most expensive cover charge in town. Baseball fans are here. And you watch. The Reds are going to run away with the division. And they're going to go deep into the playoffs. And if I know the owner, and I'll tell you what, Bob Castellini, you can say whatever you want to say. You talk about a guy who loves the city, loves the team, and will do anything. We get into July and we need players, he'll get them. And he wants to win for the city, Cincinnati. To this day, we still talk about when we were up 2-0 against San Francisco Giants and we lost 3-2. That was a team with Dusty Baker. We could have won the World Series. We're going to run away with the Central this year. You watch. And you remember that when you have a podcast next September, and you say, I'm going to play that tape right now.
Kremchek. Yes, we're going to play that tape back. Well, yeah.
And God forbid if we're in last place, don't play it.
Well, as the saying goes, from your lips to God's ears with that one. So thank you, Dr. Kremchek.
Hey, thanks for having me. I love this. I love the city, love the program, love what you guys do.
Oh, and thank you.
You guys are awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.